happiness when it had only a part claim on the problem. This is what Rank meant when he said that psychology, which is gradually trying to supplant religious and moral ideology, is only partially qualified to do this because it is a preponderantly negative and disintegrating ideology. Psychology narrows the cause for personal unhappiness down to the person himself, and then he is stuck with himself. But we know that the universal and general cause for personal badness, guilt, and inferiority is the natural world, and the person's relationship to it as a symbolic animal who must find a secure place in it. All the analysis in the world doesn't allow the person to find out who he is, and why he is here on earth, why he has to die, and how he can make his life a triumph. It is when psychology pretends to do this, when it offers itself as a full explanation of human unhappiness, that it becomes a fraud that makes the situation of modern man an impasse from which he cannot escape. Or, put another way, psychology has limited its understanding of human unhappiness to the personal life history of the individual, and has not understood how much individual unhappiness is itself a historical problem in the larger sense, a problem of the eclipse of secure communal ideologies of redemption. Rank put it this way. In the neurotic, in whom one sees the collapse of the whole human ideology of God, it has also become obvious what this signifies psychologically. This was not explained by Freud's psychoanalysis, which only comprehended the destructive process in the patient from his personal history, without considering the cultural development which bred this type. If you fail to understand this, you risk making the neurotic even worse off by closing him off from the larger worldview that he needs. As Rank put it, it was finally the understanding psychoanalyst who sent the self-conscious neurotic back to the very self-knowledge from which he wanted to escape. On the whole, psychoanalysis failed therapeutically because it aggravated man's psychologizing rather than healed him of his introspection. Or better, we would say psychoanalysis failed therapeutically where it fetishized the causes of human unhappiness as sexuality, and when it pretended to be a total worldview in itself. We can conclude with Rank that religion is just as good a psychology as the psychology that pretended to replace it. In some ways, it is of course even better, because it gets at the actual causes of universal guilt. In some ways, it is much worse, because it usually reinforces the parental and social authorities and makes the bind of circumstantial guilt even stronger and more crippling. There is no way to answer Rank's devastating relativization of modern psychology. We have only to look around at the growing number of psychological gurus in the marketplace in order to get the lived historical flavor of the thing. Modern man started looking inward in the 19th century because he hoped to find immortality in a new and secure way. He wanted heroic apotheosis, as did all other historical men. But now there is no one to give it to him except his psychological guru. He created his own impasse. In this sense, as Rank said, with what has to be a touch of ironic humor, psychotherapists are, so to say, the neurotic's product due to his illness. Modern man needs a thou to whom to turn for spiritual and moral dependence, and as God was in eclipse, the therapist has had to replace him, just as the lover and the parents did. For generations now, the psychoanalysts, not understanding this historical problem, have been trying to figure out why the termination of the transference in therapy is such a devilish problem in many cases. Had they read and understood Rank, they would quickly have seen that the thou of the therapist is the new God who must replace the old collective ideologies of redemption. As the individual cannot serve as God, he must give rise to a truly devilish problem. Note. One exception is Alan Wheelis, who discusses these very things. The need for transference, the problem of historical change and neurosis, the insufficiency of psychoanalytic therapy for finding an identity, and so on. The Quest for Identity, New York, Norton, 1958, pages 159 to 173. The whole discussion is pure Rank, although Wheelis evidently arrived at his views independently. End of note. Modern man is condemned to seek the meaning of his life in psychological introspection. And so his new confessor has to be the supreme authority on introspection, the psychoanalyst. As this is so, the patient's beyond is limited to the analytic couch and the worldview imparted there. Note: if psychology represents the analytic breakdown and dissipation of the self, and usually limits the world to the scientific ideology of the therapist, we can see some of the reasons Jung developed his own peculiar ideas. His work represents, in part, a reaction to the very limitations of psychological analysis. For one thing, he revitalized the inner dimensions of the psyche to secure it against the self-defeating analytic breakdown of it. He deepened it beyond the reaches of analysis by seeing it as a source of self-healing archetypes, of natural renewal, if the patient will only allow it. For another thing, he broadened the psyche beyond its individual base by turning it into a collective unconscious. No matter what the individual did to his psyche, he was transcended as an individual by it. In these two ways, the person could get his heroic justification from within his own psyche, even by analyzing it. In fact, especially by analyzing it. In this way, Jung's system is an attempt to have the advantages of psychological analysis and to negate and transcend them at the same time, to have his cake and eat it too. As Reif has so compellingly argued, dissatisfaction with and criticism of Jung must stem largely from the impossibility of achieving the psychological redemption of psychological man, as we will conclude in Part 3. Philip Reif, The Triumph of the Therapeutic, Uses of Faith After Freud, New York, Harper Torch Books, 1966, Chapter 5. End of note. In this sense, as Rank saw with such deep understanding, psychoanalysis actually stultifies the emotional life of the patient. Man wants to focus his love on an absolute measure of power and value, and the analyst tells him that all is reducible to his early conditioning and is therefore relative. Man wants to find and experience the marvelous, and the analyst tells him how matter-of-fact everything is, how clinically explainable are our deepest ontological motives and guilts. Man is thereby deprived of the absolute mystery he needs, and the only omnipotent thing that then remains is the man who explained it away. And so, the patient clings to the analyst with all his might and dreads terminating the analysis. Note: the emotional impoverishment of psychoanalysis must extend also to many analysts themselves and to psychiatrists who come under its ideology. This fact helps to explain the terrible deadness of emotion that one experiences in psychiatric settings, the heavy weight of the character armor erected against the world. End of note. Rank and Kierkegaard, The Merger of Sin and Neurosis. The further one pushes his study of Rank, the more his writings blur into those of Kierkegaard, all the more remarkably, as we now fully appreciate, because of the far greater sophistication of clinical psychoanalysis. By now it should be clear that this blurring of Rank and Kierkegaard is not a weak surrender to ideology, but an actual scientific working through of the problem of human character. Both men reached the same conclusion after the most exhaustive psychological quest, that at the very furthest reaches of scientific description, psychology has to give way to theology. That is, to a worldview that absorbs the individual's conflicts and guilt and offers him the possibility for some kind of heroic apotheosis. Man cannot endure his own littleness unless he can translate it into meaningfulness on the largest possible level. Here, Rank and Kierkegaard meet in one of those astonishing historical mergers of thought. That sin and neurosis are two ways of talking about the same thing. The complete isolation of the individual, his disharmony with the rest of nature, his hyper-individualism, his attempt to create his own world from within himself. Both sin and neurosis represent the individual blowing himself up to larger than his true size, his refusal to recognize his cosmic dependence. Neurosis, like sin, is an attempt to force nature, to pretend that the Kausasui project really suffices. In sin and neurosis, man fetishizes himself on something narrow at hand and pretends that the whole meaning and miraculousness of creation is limited to that, that he can get his beatification from that. Rank's summing up of the neurotic worldview is at the same time that of the classic sinner. The neurotic loses every kind of collective spirituality and makes the heroic gesture of placing himself entirely within the immortality of his own ego, as the observations and cosmic fantasies of psychotics so clearly show. But we know that this attempt is doomed to failure because man simply cannot justify his own heroism. He cannot fit himself into his own cosmic plan and make it believable. He must live with agonizing doubts if he remains in touch at all with the larger reality. Only when he loses this touch do the doubts vanish. And that is the definition of psychosis, a wholly unreal belief in the self-justification of cosmic heroism. I am Christ. In this sense, as Rank said, neurosis represents the striving for an individual religion, a self-achieved immortality. Sin and neurosis have another side. Not only their unreal self-inflation in the refusal to admit creatureliness, but also a penalty for intensified self-consciousness, the failure to be consoled by shared illusions. The result is that the sinner, neurotic, is hyper-conscious of the very thing he tries to deny, his creatureliness, his miserableness and unworthiness. The neurotic is thrown back on his true perceptions of the human condition, which caused his isolation and individuation in the first place. He tried to build a glorified private inner world because of his deeper anxieties, but life takes its revenge. The more he separates and inflates himself, the more anxious he becomes. The more he artificially idealizes himself, the more exaggeratedly he criticizes himself. He alternates between the extremes of I am everything and I am nothing. But it is clear that if one is going to be something, he has to be a secure part of something else. There is no way to avoid paying the debt of dependency and yielding to the larger meaning of the rest of nature, to the toll of suffering and the death that it demands. And there is no way to justify this payment from within oneself, no matter how mightily one tries. But now we see the historical difference between the classical sinner and the modern neurotic. Both of them experience the naturalness of human insufficiency. Only today the neurotic is stripped of the symbolic worldview, the God ideology that would make sense out of his unworthiness and would translate it into heroism. Traditional religion turned the consciousness of sin into a condition for salvation. But the tortured sense of nothingness of the neurotic qualifies him now only for miserable extinction, for merciful release in lonely death. It is all right to be nothing vis-à-vis God, who alone can make it right in his unknown ways. It is another thing to be nothing to oneself, who is nothing. Rank summed it up this way. The neurotic type suffers from a consciousness of sin, just as much as did his religious ancestor, without believing in the conception of sin. This is precisely what makes him neurotic. He feels a sinner without the religious belief in sin, for which he therefore needs a new rational explanation. Thus the plight of modern man, a sinner with no word for it, or worse, who looks for the word for it in a dictionary of psychology, and thus only aggravates the problem of his separateness and hyperconsciousness. Again, this impasse is what Rank meant when he called psychology a preponderantly negative and disintegrating ideology. Health as an ideal. We have now covered the three aspects of the problem of neurosis, as a result of character formation, as a problem of reality versus illusion, and as a result of historical circumstances. All three, of course, merge into one. Man lives his contradictions, for better or worse, in some kind of cultural project in a given historical period. Neurosis is another word for the total problem of the human condition. It becomes a clinical word when the individual bogs down in the face of the problem, when his heroism is in doubt or becomes self-defeating. Men are naturally neurotic and always have been, but at some times they have it easier than at others to mask their true condition. Men avoid clinical neurosis when they can trustingly live their heroism in some kind of self-transcending drama. Modern man lives his contradictions for the worse, because the modern condition is one in which convincing dramas of heroic apotheosis, of creative play, or of cultural illusion are in eclipse. There is no embracing worldview for the neurotic to depend on, or merge with to mask his problems, and so the cure for neurosis is difficult in our time. This is Rank's devastating Kierkegaardian conclusion. If neurosis is sin and not disease, then the only thing which can cure it is a worldview, some kind of affirmative collective ideology in which the person can perform the living drama of his acceptance as a creature. Only in this way can the neurotic come out of his isolation, to become part of such a larger and higher wholeness as religion has always represented. In anthropology, we call these the myth-ritual complexes of traditional society. Does the neurotic lack something outside him to absorb his need for perfection? Does he eat himself up with obsessions? The myth-ritual complex is a social form for the channeling of obsessions. We might say that it places creative obsession within the reach of every man, which is precisely the function of ritual. This function is what Freud saw when he talked about the obsessive quality of primitive religion and compared it to neurotic obsession. But he didn't see how natural this was, how all social life is the obsessive ritualization of control in one way or another. It automatically engineers safety and banishes despair by keeping people focused on the noses in front of their faces. The defeat of despair is not mainly an intellectual problem for an active organism, but a problem of self-stimulation via movement. Beyond a given point, man is not helped by more knowing, but only by living and doing in a partly self-forgetful way. As Goethe put it, we must plunge into experience and then reflect on the meaning of it. All reflection and no plunging drives us mad. All plunging and no reflection, and we are brutes. Goethe wrote maxims like these precisely at the time when the individual lost the protective cover of traditional society, and daily life became a problem for him. He no longer knew what were the proper doses of experience. This safe dosage of life is exactly what is prescribed by traditional custom, wherein all the important decisions of life and even its daily events are ritually marked out. Neurosis is the contriving of private obsessional ritual to replace the socially agreed one now lost by the demise of traditional society. The customs and myths of traditional society provided a whole interpretation of the meaning of life, ready-made for the individual. All he had to do was to accept living it as true. The modern neurotic must do just this if he is to be cured. He must welcome a living illusion. It is one thing to imagine this cure, but it is quite another thing to prescribe it to modern man. How hollow it must ring in his ears. For one thing, he can't get living myth-ritual complexes, the deep-going inherited social traditions that have so far sustained men, on a prescription form from the corner pharmacy. He can't even get them in mental hospitals or therapeutic communities. The modern neurotic cannot magically find the kind of world he needs, which is one reason he tries to create his own. In this very crucial sense, neurosis is the modern tragedy of man. Historically, he is an orphan. A second reason for the hollowness of our prescription for neurosis follows. If there are no ready-made traditional worldviews into which to fit oneself with dependency and trust, religion becomes a very personal matter. So personal that faith itself seems neurotic, like a private fantasy and a decision taken out of weakness. The one thing modern man cannot do is what Kierkegaard prescribed, the lonely leap into faith, the naive personal trust in some kind of transcendental support for one's life. This support is now independent of living external rituals and customs. The church and the community do not exist, or do not carry much conviction. This situation is what helps make faith fantastic. In order for something to seem true to man, it has to be visibly supported in some way, lived, external, compelling. Men need pageants, crowds, panoplies, special days marked off on calendars, an objective focus for obsession, something to give form and body to internal fantasy, something external to yield oneself to. Otherwise, the neurotic is brought back to the point of his departure. How is he to believe in his lonely inner sense of specialness? Note. I think this helps explain the intensive evangelism of so many converts. Offhand, we may wonder why they must continually buttonhole us in the street to tell us how to be as happy as they. If they are so happy, we muse, why are they bugging us? The reason, according to what we have said, must be that they need the conviction of numbers in order to strengthen and externalize something that otherwise remains very private and personal, and so risks seeming fantastic and unreal. To see others like oneself is to believe in oneself. End of note. A third problem is that modern man is the victim of his own disillusionment. He has been disinherited by his own analytic strength. The characteristic of the modern mind is the banishment of mystery, of naive belief, of simple-minded hope. We put the accent on the visible, the clear, the cause and effect relation, the logical, always the logical. We know the difference between dreams and reality, between facts and fictions, between symbols and bodies. But right away, we can see that these characteristics of the modern mind are exactly those of neurosis. What typifies the neurotic is that he knows his situation vis-à-vis reality. He has no doubts. There is nothing you can say to sway him, to give him hope or trust. He is a miserable animal whose body decays, who will die, who will pass into dust and oblivion, disappear forever, not only in this world, but in all the possible dimensions of the universe, whose life serves no conceivable purpose, who may as well not have been born, and so on and so forth. He knows truth and reality, the motives of the entire universe. It was G.K. Chesterton who kept alive the spirit of Kierkegaard and naive Christianity in modern thought, as when he showed with such style that the characteristics the modern mind prides itself on are precisely those of madness. There is no one more logical than the lunatic, more concerned with the minutiae of cause and effect. Madmen are the greatest reasoners we know, and that trait is one of the accompaniments of their undoing. All their vital processes are shrunken into the mind. What is the one thing they lack that sane men possess? The ability to be careless, to disregard appearances, to relax and laugh at the world. They can't unbend, can't gamble their whole existence, as did Pascal, on a fanciful wager. They can't do what religion has always asked, to believe in a justification of their lives that seems absurd. The neurotic knows better. He is the absurd, but nothing else is absurd. It is only too true. But faith asks that man expand himself trustingly into the non-logical, into the truly fantastic. This spiritual expansion is the one thing that modern man finds most difficult, precisely because he is constricted into himself and has nothing to lean on, no collective drama that makes fantasy seem real, because it is lived and shared. Let me hasten to assure the reader that I am not developing an apologia for traditional religion, but only describing the impoverishment of the modern neurotic and some of the reasons for it. I want to give some background for understanding how centrally Ranke himself stands in the tradition of Pascal, Kierkegaard, and Chesterton on the problem of faith and illusion or creative play. As we have learned from Huizinga and more recent writers like Joseph Pieper and Harvey Cox, the only secure truth men have is that which they themselves create and dramatize. To live is to play at the meaning of life. The upshot of this whole tradition of thought is that it teaches us once and for all that childlike foolishness is the calling of mature men. Just this way, Ranke prescribed the cure for neurosis as the need for legitimate foolishness. The problem of the union of religion, psychiatry, and social science is contained in this one formula. We said earlier that the question of human life is, on what level of illusion does one live? This question poses an absolutely new question for the science of mental health, namely, what is the best illusion under which to live? Or, what is the most legitimate foolishness? If you are going to talk about life-enhancing illusion, then you can truly try to answer the question of which is best. You will have to define best in terms that are directly meaningful to man, related to his basic condition and his needs. I think the whole question would be answered in terms of how much freedom, dignity, and hope a given illusion provides. These three things absorb the problem of natural neurosis and turn it to creative living. We have to look for the answer to the problem of freedom where it is most absent. In the transference, the fatal and crushing enslaver of men. The transference fetishizes mystery, terror, and power. It holds the self bound in its grip. Religion answers directly to the problem of transference by expanding awe and terror to the cosmos, where they belong. It also takes the problem of self-justification and removes it from the objects near at hand. We no longer have to please those around us, but the very source of creation, the powers that created us, not those in whose lives we accidentally fell. Our life ceases to be a reflexive dialogue with the standards of our wives, husbands, friends, and leaders, and becomes instead measured by standards of the highest heroism, ideals truly fit to lead us on and beyond ourselves. In this way, we will fill ourselves with independent values, can make free decisions, and most importantly, can lean on powers that really support us and do not oppose us. The personality can truly begin to emerge in religion because God, as an abstraction, does not oppose the individual as others do, but instead provides the individual with all the powers necessary for independent self-justification. What greater security than to lean confidently on God, on the fount of creation, the most terrifying power of all? If God is hidden and intangible, all the better. That allows man to expand and develop by himself. The problem of transference is thus, like all things human, partly a value problem, a question of ideals. Freud tried to keep it wholly scientific by showing how exaggerated and false transference perceptions of reality were, which to a great extent is of course true. But what is the norm of true perception? Here, Freud himself had to hedge. What is more unreal than the perceptions of a normal person in love, who is carried into rapture and expansion of being by his very exaggerations? Vanderlave, that great psychologist of religion, saw the problem of transference and rejections more broadly than Freud. He cites an ancient Egyptian text in which a certain Pahari discusses his inner conscience as the voice of God dwelling within man, and then Vanderlave says, "Now it is possible, certainly, with Nietzsche and Freud, to ascribe the strangeness of the voice which warns us to avoid to infantilism, not the voice of God in the heart of man, but the voice of some men in man," says Nietzsche. But Vanderlave concludes on a surprising note. "We may, however, prefer the Egyptian description. On this point, phenomenology has no decision to make." In other words, we may prefer it for the larger expansiveness of being that it represents, as more imaginatively it links the person with higher mysterious powers. God consciousness is not only regressive transference, but also creative possibility. But unlike Vanderlave, we are arguing that on this matter psychology does have a decision to make. It can talk about less constricting forms of transference. Best of all, of course, religion solves the problem of death, which no living individuals can solve, no matter how they would support us. Religion, then, gives the possibility of heroic victory and freedom, and solves the problem of human dignity at its highest level. The two ontological motives of the human condition are both met. The need to surrender oneself in full to the rest of nature, to become a part of it by laying down one's whole existence to some higher meaning, and the need to expand oneself as an individual heroic personality. Finally, religion alone gives hope, because it holds open the dimension of the unknown and the unknowable, the fantastic mystery of creation that the human mind cannot even begin to approach. The possibility of a multidimensionality of spheres of existence, of heavens and possible embodiments that make a mockery of earthly logic, and in doing so, it relieves the absurdity of earthly life, all the impossible limitations and frustrations of living matter. In religious terms, to see God is to die, because the creature is too small and finite to be able to bear the higher meanings of creation. Religion takes one's very creatureliness, one's insignificance, and makes it a condition of hope. Full transcendence of the human condition means limitless possibility, unimaginable to us. What is the ideal for mental health, then? A lived, compelling illusion that does not lie about life, death, and reality, one honest enough to follow its own commandments. I mean, not to kill, not to take the lives of others to justify itself. Rank saw Christianity as a truly great ideal foolishness in the sense that we have been discussing it, a childlike trust and hope for the human condition that left open the realm of mystery. Obviously, all religions fall far short of their own ideals, and Rank was talking about Christianity not as practiced, but as an ideal. Christianity, like all religions, has in practice reinforced the regressive transference into an even more choking bind. The fathers are given the sanction of divine authority. But as an ideal, Christianity, on all the things we have listed, stands high, perhaps even highest in some vital ways, as people like Kierkegaard, Chesterton, the Niebuhrs, and so many others have compellingly argued. The curious thing, as we can now fully appreciate, is that Rank, after a lifetime of work, drew the circle of psychoanalysis itself on this tradition of thought. In this, he stands side by side with Jung, as Progoff so well showed. Note. There are many other names one could mention in the synthesis of psychoanalytic, existential, and theological thought. We have already noted Waldman's work, which carries the synthesis all the way back to Adler, as Progoff also showed. Thus, we are not talking about an accidental convergence or unusual similarity, but also a solid cumulative achievement of several major strands of thought. Igor A. Caruso's important book, Existential Psychology from Analysis to Synthesis, New York, Herder and Herder, 1964, is an excellent Rankian statement on neurosis. See also Wilfried Dime, On Depth Psychology and Salvation, Journal of Psychotherapy as a Religious Process, 1955, 2, 24-37, for another part of the modern movement of the closure of psychoanalysis on Kierkegaard. One of the first modern attempts in this direction, perhaps the first, was that of Freud's friend, the Reverend Oscar Pfister, who wrote a massive work on anxiety translated as Christianity and Fear, London, Allen and Unwin, 1948. It took anxiety as a mainspring of conduct from John through Kierkegaard, Heidegger, and Freud. His intent was to show that anxiety is best overcome through the immortality ideology of Christian love. This is not the place to assess Pfister's extensive study and argument, but it is important to note that the work is vitiated by a curious failure to understand that the anxiety of life and death is a universal characteristic of man. He sides with those who believe that a healthy development of the child can take place without guilt, and that a full expression of love can banish fear. Nor is it true that this predisposition to fear must necessarily be called into play by existence in the world as such. That existence in the world as such causes fear is true only of persons who have been disposed to fear by various damnings. Page 49. He says that Kierkegaard had a fear neurosis based on his difficult childhood, hence his morbidity. The curious thing is that Pfister failed to get behind the cultural immortality ideology that absorbs and transmutes fear, even while he recognized it. Many persons, not only children and the aged, find it possible to face death. They may even welcome it as a friend and be ready to die for a great cause. Ibid. This is true, but, as we now know, it is also trivial, because it does not come to grips with the transference transmutations of reality and power. The result is a book that offers a sort of Wilhelm Reich Norman Brown thesis of the possibilities of unrepressed living, with Christ as the focus for Eros. All of which leads to the rumination that when liberal Christianity seizes upon Freud to try to make the world the cheerfully right place, such unusual partners in such an unchristian venture are bound to produce something false. End of note. Finally, if mental health is a problem of ideal illusion, we are left with one large question on the matter of human character. If we are talking about the best ideal, then we should also talk about the costs of lesser ideals. What is the toll taken on the human personality by a failure to fully meet the twin ontological needs of man? Again, we are back to the problem of Freud's life. What is the cost of the denial of absolute transcendence, of the attempt to fabricate one's own religion? When a man fails to draw the powers of his existence from the highest source, what is the cost to himself and those around him? We haven't even begun to discuss questions like this in characterology, but it seems to me that they are basic and necessary, the key questions, without which we cannot even talk about mental health intelligently. Rank posed the basic question. He asked whether the individual is able at all to affirm and accept himself from himself. But he quickly sidestepped it by saying that it cannot be said. Only the creative type can do this, to some extent, he reasoned, by using his work as a justification for his existence. I myself have posed this question as a central one for the science of man, in ignorance of the work of Rank. I think it can be answered as Rank himself elsewhere answered it. As we saw in the last chapter, even the creative type should ideally surrender to higher powers than himself. It was Jung, with his analytical penetration, who saw also the reason, which is that the unusual person takes his transference projections back into himself. As we said in the last chapter, one reason for his creativity is that he sees the world on his own terms and relies on himself. But this leads to a dangerous kind of megalomania, because the individual becomes too full with his own meanings. Furthermore, if you don't fetishize the world by transference perceptions, totalities of experience put a tremendous burden on the ego and risk annihilating it. The creative person is too full both of himself and of the world. Again, as the creative person has the same personality problems as the neurotic, and the same biting off of the wholeness of experience, he needs some kind of resolution in a new and greater dependency. Ideally, a freely chosen dependency, as Rank said. As we saw so poignantly with Freud, the strongest among us faint away like children when pushed to take the whole meaning of life on themselves, to support it with their own meager creature powers. We said at the end of Chapter 6 that Freud couldn't take the step from scientific to religious creatureliness. As Jung understood only too well, that would have meant Freud's abandoning of his own peculiar passion as a genius. Jung must have understood it from within his own experience. He himself could never bring himself to visit Rome, because, as he admitted, Rome raised questions which were beyond my powers to handle. In my old age, in 1949, I wished to repair this omission, but was stricken with a faint while I was buying tickets. After that, the plans for a trip to Rome were once and for all laid aside. What are we to make of all these giants fainting at the prospect of what to us seems simple tourism? Freud, too, had not been able to visit Rome until later in life, and turned back each time he approached the city. I think we can fully understand this problem now that we have discussed Rank's closure on Kierkegaard, especially his psychology of the artist. These men had problems that no simple tourist knows. They were innovators, who tried to give a whole new meaning to creation and history, which meant that they had to support and justify all previous meanings, and all possible alternative ones on their shoulders alone. Probably Rome epitomized these meanings in herself, her ruins and her history, and so she made their legs quiver. How much human blood was soaked into her soil? How many human dramas were played out there with what must seem, in the perspective of history, such unfeeling and extravagant wastefulness? It raises a problem just like that of the dinosaurs that troubled Freud, or of the deformed infants that mocked Luther, only now on the level of all human beings. We mentioned in Chapter 6 that when Freud himself came to analyze his reluctances about Rome and his strange experience on the Acropolis, he saw that somehow the memory of his father stood in judgment of his own achievements. He said he was troubled by a feeling of piety for him. I think if we push the analysis to its ultimate point, we have to say that each earthly father accuses us of our impotence if we become truly creative personalities. They remind us that we are born of men and not gods. No living person can give genius the powers it needs to shoulder the meaning of the world. Yet what are we to say about this problem if even Jung, who always relied on God, could still faint away with the burden of life? Probably, in the last analysis, only this: that all men are here to use themselves up, and the problem of ideal illusion doesn't spare any man from that. It only addresses the question of the best quality of work and life that men can achieve, depending on the beliefs that they have and the powers they lean on. And this subject, as we said, is a matter for discussion by the empirical science of psychology itself. We have to reason about the highest actualization that man can achieve. At its ultimate point, the science of psychology meets again the questioning figure of Kierkegaard. What worldview? What powers? For what heroism? Chapter 10. A General View of Mental Illness. The essential basic arch-anxiety, primal anxiety, is innate to all isolated individual forms of human existence. In the basic anxiety, human existence is afraid of, as well as anxious about, its being in the world. Only if we understand this can we conceive of the seemingly paradoxic phenomenon that people who are afraid of living are also especially frightened of death. Medard Boss. I remember one of my college professors, a man very much admired as a teacher of medieval history, confessing that the more he learned about the period, the less he was prepared to say. The epoch was so complex, so diversified, that no general statement could safely be made about it. The same thing can surely be said about the theory of mental illness. How dare someone try to write a chapter entitled A General View of Such a Complex and Varied Phenomenon, especially someone who is not himself a psychiatrist? In fact, I have had an unusually difficult time forcing myself to sit down and write this chapter, even though I feel it belongs in the book. The literature is there for all to see, the record of lifetimes of work by some of the greatest psychologists who have ever lived, men possessing the richest personal sensitivities, work reflecting unusual theoretical gifts, and based on the most extensive and varied clinical materials. Why should someone try to rake this area over again, in what can only be a superficial and simple-minded way? Probably for that very reason. Today we need simple-mindedness in order to be able to say anything at all. This is the other side of the coin of the confession of the medievalist. The great characteristic of our time is that we know everything important about human nature that there is to know, yet never has there been an age in which so little knowledge is securely possessed, so little a part of the common understanding. The reason is precisely the advance of specialization, the impossibility of making safe general statements, which has led to a general imbecility. What I would like to do in these few pages is to run the risk of simple-mindedness in order to make some dent in the unintended imbecility brought about by specialization and its mountains of fact. Even if I succeed only poorly, it seems like a worthwhile barter. In such a stifling and crushing scientific epoch, someone has to be willing to play the fool in order to relieve the general myopia. Right away, the expert will say that it is presumptuous to talk about a general theory of mental illness, that this is something far in the future, a distant and perhaps unattainable goal, as if we didn't already have such a theory securely lodged in the countless volumes that crowd our libraries and bookstores. The gigantic figures of modern psychology have given us a thorough understanding of human behavior in both its neurotic and psychotic aspects, as well as its perversions of all types. The problem is, as we have said, how to put some kind of general order into this wealth of insight and knowledge. One way is to make the most general statements about it, the same kind of statements that we have used so far in this book to tie together diverse areas of fact. Is man an animal who fears death, who seeks self-perpetuation and heroic transcendence of his fate? Then failure for such an animal is failure to achieve heroic transcendence. As Adler put it so succinctly in the epigraph we have borrowed for this part of the book, mental illness is a way of talking about people who have lost courage, which is the same as saying that it reflects the failure of heroism. This conclusion follows logically from the discussion of the problem of neurosis in the previous chapter. We saw there that the neurotic was one who especially could not stand his own creatureliness, who couldn't surround his anality with convincing illusion. It was Adler who saw that low self-esteem was the central problem of mental illness. When does the person have the most trouble with his self-esteem? Precisely when his heroic transcendence of his fate is most in doubt, when he doubts his own immortality, the abiding value of his life, when he is not convinced that his having lived really makes any cosmic difference. From this point of view, we might well say that mental illness represents styles of bogging down in the denial of creatureliness. Depression. We would not get very far with general statements like these if we could not show how they sum up the specifics of each syndrome. Fortunately, we can do just that. Adler had already revealed how perfectly depression, or melancholia, is a problem of courage, how it develops in people who are afraid of life, who have given up any semblance of independent development, and have been totally immersed in the acts and the aid of others. They have lived lives of systematic self-restriction, and the result is that the less you do, the less you can do, the more helpless and dependent you become. The more you shrink back from the difficulties and the darings of life, the more you naturally come to feel inept, the lower is your self-evaluation. It is ineluctable. If one's life has been a series of silent retreats, one ends up firmly wedged into a corner and has nowhere else to retreat. This state is the bogging down of depression. Fear of life leads to excessive fear of death, as Boss too reminds us in the epigraph we have borrowed for this chapter. Finally, one doesn't dare to move. The patient lies in bed for days on end, not eating, letting the housework pile up, fouling the bed. The moral of this example of failure of courage is that in some way one must pay with life and consent daily to die, to give oneself up to the risks and dangers of the world, allow oneself to be engulfed and used up. Otherwise, one ends up as though dead in trying to avoid life and death. This is how modern existentialist psychiatrists understand depression, exactly as Adler did at the beginning of this century. Medard Boss sums it up in a few lines. It is always the whole existence of the melancholic patient, which has failed to take over openly and responsibly all those possibilities of relating to the world, which actually would constitute his own genuine self. Consequently, such an existence has no independent standing of its own, but continually falls prey to the demands, wishes, and expectations of others. Such patients try to live up to these foreign expectations as best they can, in order not to lose the protection and love of their surroundings. But they go more deeply into debt. Hence, the terrible guilt feelings of the melancholic derive from his existential guilt. The interesting scientific question here is why we have had so much trouble getting agreement on the simple dynamics of depression, when it had been revealed so early and so lucidly by Adler and now again by the School of Existential Psychiatry. One of the reasons is that the dynamics are not so simple as they appear. They go very deeply into the heart of the human condition, and we have not been able to read this heart in any straightforward or easy way. For one thing, we ourselves had so effectively banished the idea of the fear of death and life, we were not sufficiently impressed by the terror of the living creature, and so we could not understand the torturings and turnings of anguished people who were jerked about by these terrors. For example, despite Adler's excellent and early general theory, he put us off somewhat by talking about the selfishness and the pamperedness of the depressed person, the spoiled child who refuses to grow up and accept the responsibility for his life, and so on. Of course, these things are true to some extent, and Adler fully realized that nature herself had made man a weakling in the animal kingdom. But the accent is important. Adler should have stressed more the sheer terror of individuation, of difference, of being alone, of losing support and delegated power. He revealed to us the life lie that people use in order to live, but we tended to overlook how necessary this lie is in some form or other for most men. How men simply do not have their own powers to rely on. When we remind ourselves again how giants like Freud and Jung shrink and faint while buying simple travel tickets, perhaps we can get some correct feeling for the magnitude of the task of poor Mr. Average Man, just daily trying to negotiate a semblance of tranquil heroism by embedding himself in the powers of others. When these tactics fail and he is threatened with the exposure of his life lie, how logical it is that he give way to his own version of fainting by bogging down in a depressive withdrawal. Another complexity of the dynamics of depression that we overlooked was the one that Rank taught us, the urge to immortalization and self-perpetuation by pleasing the other, by conforming to the code of behavior that he represents. People hunger for immortality and get it where they can, in the small family circle or in the single love object. The transference object is the locus of our conscience, of our whole cosmology of good and evil. It is not something we can simply break away from, as it embodies our whole hero system. We saw how complete and complex the transference can be. We obey our authority figures all our lives, as Freud showed, because of the anxiety of separation. Every time we try to do something other than what they wanted, we awaken the anxiety connected with them and their possible loss. To lose their powers and approval is thus to lose our very lives. Also, we saw that the transference object in itself embodies the mysterium tremendum of existence. It is the primary miracle. In its concrete existence, it transcends mere symbolic commands. And what is more natural than conforming to this miraculousness? We must add, with Rank, what is more natural than continuing to strive for immortality by fulfilling the moral code represented by the object? Transference is the positive use of the object for eternal self-perpetuation. This explains the durability of transference and its strength, even after the death of the object. I am immortal by continuing to please this object, who now may not be alive but continues to cast a shadow by what it has left behind, and may even be working its powers from the invisible spirit world. This is a part of the psychology of ancient ancestor worshippers, as well as of moderns, who continue to live according to family codes of honor and conduct. Depression, then, sums up both the terror of life and death and the hunger for self-perpetuation. How heroic can one get? It is so natural to try to be heroic in the safe and small circle of family or with the loved one, to give in to a silent retreat now and then, to keep this heroics secure. How many people have an independent gift to give to the cosmos in order to assure their special immortality? Only the creative person can manage that. When the average person can no longer convincingly perform his safe heroics, or cannot hide his failure to be his own hero, then he bogs down in the failure of depression and its terrible guilt. I particularly like Galen's insight that the bogging down into total helplessness and dependency in depression is itself the last and most natural defense available to the mammalian animal. Dependency is the basic survival mechanism of the human organism. When the adult gives up hope and his ability to cope, and sees himself incapable of either fleeing or fighting, he is reduced to a state of depression. This very reduction, with its parallel to the helplessness of infancy, becomes a plea for a solution to the problem of survival via dependency. The very stripping of one's defenses becomes a form of defensive maneuver. Boss says that the terrible guilt feelings of the depressed person are existential. That is, they represent the failure to live one's own life, to fulfill one's own potential because of the twisting and turning to be good in the eyes of the other. The other calls the tune to one's eligibility for immortality, and so the other takes up one's unlived life. Relationship is thus always slavery of a kind, which leaves a residue of guilt. A modern therapist like Frederick Perls actively worked against this tyranny by reminding his patients that they were not in the world to please their partner, nor he to please them. It was a way of cutting into the morality of personal performance for immortality. All this is very good, but it can hardly sum up all the guilt that the patient feels, or at least accuses himself of. To judge by his own self-accusations of worthlessness, the patient feels an immense burden of guilt. We have to understand this self-accusation not only as a reflection of guilt over unlived life, but also as a language for making sense out of one's situation. In short, even if one is a very guilty hero, he is at least a hero in the same hero system. The depressed person uses guilt to hold on to his objects and to keep his situation unchanged. Otherwise, he would have to analyze it, or be able to move out of it and transcend it. Better guilt than the terrible burden of freedom and responsibility, especially when the choice comes too late in life for one to be able to start over again. Better guilt and self-punishment when you cannot punish the other, when you cannot even dare to accuse him, as he represents the immortality ideology with which you have identified. If your God is discredited, you yourself die. The evil must be in yourself and not in your God so that you may live. With guilt, you lose some of your life, but avoid the greater evil of death. The depressed person exaggerates his guilt because it unblocks his dilemma in the safest and easiest way. He also, as Adler pointed out, gets the people around him to respond to him, to pity him, and to value him and take care of him. He controls them and heightens his own personality by his very self-pity and self-hatred. All these things, then, make obsessive guilt prominent in the depression syndrome. We can thus see some of the complexities of the dynamics of depression that have made it hard for us to understand it in an agreed and straightforward way, even though it is rather simple when conceptualized as the natural bogging down of an unheroic human life. One of the things that hinders us, too, was Freud's language and worldview. The Freudian said the menopausal depression, for example, was triggered by a re-experiencing of the early castration anxiety. It was easy to scoff at this explanation. It seemed that the Freudians were intent on once again reducing the problems of an adult life to the Oedipal period, and to their own patriarchal worldview. Here she was again, the poor castrated woman paying the debt of her natural disadvantages. I myself reacted to this a decade ago with the temerity that comes with inexperience and brashness, and offered a theory to counter it, a theory that went to the very opposite extreme and focused on the failure of social role and that alone. I saw that often menopausal women in psychiatric hospitals were there because their lives were no longer useful. In some cases, their role as wives had failed because of a late divorce. In others, this circumstance combined with the expiration of their role as mothers because their children had grown up and married, and they were now alone with nothing meaningful to do. As they had never learned any social role, trade, or skill outside of their work in the family, when the family no longer needed them, they were literally useless. That their depression coincided with the time of menopause, I thought was an excellent illustration that the failure of useful social role could alone be called upon to explain the illness. We encounter the Freudian worldview and language at almost every turn as a peculiar scientific problem. It contains a powerful truth that is phrased in such a manner as to be untrue. And we ourselves often get hung up ridiculously trying to untangle the two, or we throw the truth out with the untrue accent. I suppose one has to be brash to do anything at all in the present state of proliferation of specialists, but it is dangerous. An occasional scoffer cannot wish away a half-century of clinical observation and thought. A constant danger in science is that each gain risks abandoning ground that was once securely annexed. Nowhere is this more true than in the present role theories of mental illness that threaten to abandon the Freudian formulations based on bodily facts. The fact is that the woman's experience of a repetition of castration at menopause is a real one. Not in the narrow focus that Freud used, but rather in the broader sense of Rank, the existentialists, and Brown. As Boss so well said, castration fear is only an inroad, or an aperture whereby the anxiety inherent in all existence may break into one's world. It will be easy for us to understand at this point that menopause simply reawakens the horror of the body, the utter bankruptcy of the body as a viable casus belli project, the exact experience that brings on the early Oedipal castration anxiety. The woman is reminded in the most forceful way that she is an animal thing. Menopause is a sort of animal birthday that specifically marks the physical career of degeneration. It is like nature imposing a definite physical milestone on the person, putting up a wall and saying, "You are not going any further into life now. You are going toward the end, to the absolute determinism of death." As men don't have such animal birthdays, such specific markers of a physical kind, they don't usually experience another stark discrediting of the body as a casus belli project. Once has been enough, and they bury the problem with the symbolic powers of the cultural worldview. But the woman is less fortunate. She is put in the position of having all at once to catch up psychologically with the physical facts of life. To paraphrase Goethe's aphorism, death doesn't keep knocking on her door only to be ignored, as men ignore their aging, but kicks it in to show himself full in the face. Note: we might interject here that from this point of view, one of the crucial projects of a person's life, of true maturity, is to resign oneself to the process of aging. It is important for the person gradually to assimilate his true age, to stop protesting his youth, pretending that there is no end to his life. Eliot Jacques, in his truly superb little essay, Death and the Midlife Crisis, in H.M. Rutenbeek, editor, Death, Interpretations, New York, Delta Books, 1969, Chapter 13, beautifully develops the idea of the need for self-mourning, the mourning of one's own eventual death, and thus the working of it out of one's unconscious where it blocks one's emotional maturity. One must, so to speak, work himself out of his own system. By a study of these dynamics, we see how important it is for a man to resign himself to his earthly condition, his creatureliness, and we seem to have put full scientific closure on James's early insight on the place of inner emotional collapse in personal growth. James, Varieties, page 99. We might say that in this sense, Freud developed the dynamics for the total resignation that he could not himself quite manage. His ingenious discovery of the process called mourning labor can now be understood as basic to the resignation of the person himself. See Perls's Important Appreciation in Ego, Hunger, and Aggression, New York, Vintage Books, pages 96 and 97, which reaffirms the total bodily character of this process. We can also better understand how cultural forces conspire to produce menopausal depression in any society that lies to the person about the stages of life, that has no provision in its worldview for the mourning of one's creatureliness, and that does not provide some kind of larger heroic design into which to resign oneself securely, as we will see. End of note. Once again, we see that psychoanalysis has to be broadened to take in the fear of death rather than fears of punishment from the parents. It is not the parents who are the castrators, but nature herself. Probably the guilt feelings of the patient also express the new real self-evaluation over being merely a fecal animal, dirty and truly worthless. But now we see, too, how the Freudian view and the sociological view merge naturally into one. Normally, the cultural casuistry project masks the re-experience of castration anxiety. But it is precisely the failure of the social role, the cultural project, that then reinforces the natural animal helplessness.